You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, members of Congress face a tough balancing act between spending time in the nation's capital and getting in touch with voters back home. We'll find out how Wisconsin's delegation splits their time after 5:30. First, we go behind the scenes in the art world. Robert Storr is a curator, an art critic, and a painter. He's also dean of the Yale School of Art. Let's take a look back at a conversation we had with him before he visited Wisconsin. Robert Storr, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, as a museum audience person who doesn't really know what's going on behind the scenes, I'm excited to talk to you about this. One thing I've noticed over the years in museums is kind of two different approaches to displaying art. Some places, it's almost a history lesson, lots of context, educational material, maybe even a recorded something. And then others, it's almost as though there's artist and title, and that's it, and it leaves it all to my interpretation. Is that a back and forth in the art world?
It's a back and forth, and it's a back and forth in the work of a given curator. I've done shows with no labels whatsoever, although I always give handouts that people can read at their discretion. And I've done shows that have been heavily posted with information. It depends upon the art. It depends upon the audience.
And what makes that decision? What kind of art? What kind of audience would you put more material out there for?
Well, for starters, with audience, if you can't assume that they know a good deal already, it's not really very democratic to just throw them into the deep end of the pool. On the other hand, you never want to talk down to the audience, no matter what you're dealing with. So, for example, if you were showing religious art of the 16th century, nowadays it might be necessary to explain the Bible stories that are in the pictures, whereas once upon a time people pretty much knew them. If you're looking at art that has an origin in some important chapter of modern art history and people don't know it, then you do them a service by telling them. But going to a museum is not going to a classroom, and an exhibition should not be a book on the wall.
And you've done a lot of work with the works of living artists. Is there ever a tension between putting up that information and the artist saying, no, that's not quite right?
Well, first of all, artists don't necessarily have the definitive answer either. Mm. So you listen to artists, but you don't. I've never done an exhibition where the artist told me what to do, nor ever accepted that an artist edit my catalog text. Mm. If they want to work with me, then they have to accept that I will interpret things in ways that they might think otherwise. On the other hand, I'm sensitive to what they think, and I do a lot of asking and interviewing before I go forward.
I've seen you quoted as saying something along the lines of, you're trying to create a forum where art and ideas can meet in an exhibit. How do you do that?
And where the public can meet itself, because, of course, members of the public differ, and they will see things differently. And you want them to understand that, number one, there is no right answer. Number two, the differences among them in interpretation, in emotional response, in pleasure, are important and part of the work of art itself. And therefore, you want to stimulate dialogue among them, as well as between them and the work, them and the museum, them and the artist.
I think sometimes there's a perception from, I guess, the ordinary man or woman on the street that there's this art world out there that doesn't have much to do with our everyday life. Is that true? And is that necessarily a bad thing?
Well, there are parts of it that don't have much to do with their everyday life, even mine, which is pretty much committed to art. But I think the idea of a super elitist art world that looks down on the public is actually mistaken. And I think the idea that artists are trying to hoodwink the public is, in most cases, also mistaken. Making art is just too hard. And for most people, it's something that they don't get paid much for. There are huge prices for some things and very little reward for others. So the first thing you should sort of grant for the sake of better understanding is that maybe this crazy thing you're looking at was not done by a crazy person and was not done in order to get your goat. It was done because they had an insight that you have not yet had, and you're welcome to it if you wish.
I wonder about understanding the biography of the artist. Sometimes at talking to authors and you ask, oh, did this personal experience inform your writing? And very often the answer is no, not at all. Do we understand an artist better if we know their story as a person and as an artist?
In some instances, yes. In others, no. In some cases, for example, Louise Bourgeois, with whom I worked for 30 years very closely, began talking about early childhood experience in her life a couple of years before she became truly famous. And those stories ended up being the sort of the prism through which people see her art. And that's been a problem for her because people haven't given her enough credit for the intelligence and the sort of synthetic imagination, and they sort of ascribe it to this acting out of trauma. to a fault, right? And the same thing happened with Jackson Pollock. The reason Jackson Pollock made all those paintings was not because he drank hard or because he had a conflicted identity. It's because he was thinking about painting in a very specific way. So biography can be useful. It can also actually get in the way in a major fashion.
You've done exhibits in a lot of different places, and I want to talk about a couple of them. One, in Venice, you were, as I understand it, the first American to curate the big Biennale, forgive
right.
my Italian, back in 2007, I think.
That's correct. Yeah.
What was it like being on that? I guess that is a big deal in the international art world. What was it like to do a show on that stage?
It's a very big deal. It was a very controversial Biennale. I am still feeling the repercussions of it in some ways. But it was also very exciting, and I worked with a colleague, Italian colleague, Francesco Pizzopaolo, who was a marvelous help in trying to navigate the Italian part of the equation. Doing anything in Italy is difficult. The fact that they had Berlusconi for their prime minister tells you how difficult. And anything in Venice is difficult by Italian standards times two. So...
How was it controversial? What rose up that's still sticking with you to this day?
Well, I tried to actually do what a lot of curators talk about. I tried to make a truly international multimedia exhibition where the curator was not the subject, but the art was the subject, and where the differences among the works of art were also the subject. And that really grated with a lot of colleagues who see themselves as kind of super producers of exhibitions, with the artists and the art being basically cast members.
And I had thought when I saw you did that, well, however hard it might have been, at least you're in Venice, but do you really get to appreciate a city when you're doing this big, high-profile project?
Well, I took my wife and our two daughters, and they had a great time. I had a good time, but I didn't have a great time because I was working too hard. But it's a wonderful city, and now when I go to it, I feel kind of a pride of citizenship almost.
And another premier art place, the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Talk about working in that venue.
Well, I worked there altogether on staff for 12 years, and then I worked for another 3 years after that to produce my last exhibition. And I had a wonderful time for most of that time. And I have many, many friends among the trustees, among staff members, and so on to this day. I did not get along with the director and ultimately realized that it was a no-win situation, so I left. But it's an amazing institution with all its flaws, and it will continue to be one.
And you've done art in American embassies. Can you talk about bringing artwork outside of the traditional galleries and museums?
Well, American embassies are a place where an awful lot of the world that doesn't actually come to our shores meets America. And the whole history of art in public buildings, particularly government buildings, is a very problematic one, and none of the artists I work with want to have their art be used as cultural propaganda or as being symbolic of a particular political message. I think many of them actually kind of dissent from a good deal of what the United States has done in recent years. But it's important that their work be known. And in the same way that people would read the novels of Kurt Vonnegut or any number of writers who have been very challenging to America's image of itself, the art of America is like that. And it's good that it be in a place like that, and that people, when they come to do their business with the country, also see that we have a sense of humor about ourselves, also see that we disagree amongst ourselves, also see that we are of many colors and many cultures.
And speaking of culture, I think there's often an idea that in America, culture has to be culture, with a British accent, maybe a better one than I just delivered. Do we reach too much across the Atlantic for our ideas of high culture? Do we have enough of a uniquely American sense of our culture?
Well, I would say yes, but in the following specific way. I think we should talk no longer about the United States as being America, but the United States as being one of the Americas in the plural. And I think that from Tierra del Fuego to Baffin Bay, all of the countries with their different languages and their different ethnic mixes and so on and so forth belong to the post-colonial history of the great empires of Europe. And how each one of those countries has dealt with that legacy, how each one of these countries has produced its own modernist art, is really, really interesting. So rather than seeing the United States as an isolated case, we should see the entire hemisphere as being a zone of cultural invention and of cultural conflict, and that all of it is interesting. And sometimes the best way to understand what was done in New York is to look at what was done in Sao Paulo or in Caracas or someplace else.
How do you play with that in an exhibit setting?
That's one of the things I did in Venice. That's one of the things I've done here. I mean, I recently invited Jack Lerner, who's a Brazilian artist, to come and live at Yale and make work with students, and she created an entire exhibition while at Yale. And her way of dealing with, now I will get into the cultural jargon, but the ready-made and the Duchampian kind of idea of art making is very different than what North Americans think of that. So to have a Brazilian tap into the same source but come up with something radically different was very useful.
Your talk in Madison is on Mr. and Ms. Inside Outside. In a nutshell, what kind of topics are you tackling there?
What I'm trying to address is the fact that often the world views, again, the culture a little bit, as you said, is the them and us situation. There's this cultural lead and there's everybody else. And then beyond that, there's this view as within that cultural lead, there are the power players in institutions and everybody else. But many of the most progressive, most imaginative, most risk-taking people in the art world actually work for museums, and they get very little credit for it. And they are often the best allies that artists have in terms of getting their work understood, seen, et cetera. So I want to talk a little bit about the fact that it's not a battle between the establishment and the avant-garde. It's a struggle that people in every possible position in the art world have in common if they really care about art more than money or prestige or all those other things.
We're talking to curator extraordinaire Robert Storr. In a few minutes, I'll ask him to talk about some of the artists he's written about over the years. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue the conversation with art critic and curator Robert Storr of Yale University. Robert, I wanted to ask you about some of the artists you've written about. You mentioned Jackson Pollock earlier. It's a name a lot of us are familiar with. There's been a movie. His art's pretty well known. Why was he such a significant figure in 20th century American art?
Well, he was the one member of a large group of painters who sort of came to the fore in the late 30s, early 40s. The one member who made the most radically different paintings in terms of what modern art had looked up until that time. There's a famous quote of his where he said, you know, well, Picasso's the man to beat. But he's really the one who not only challenged Picasso directly, but made something that Picasso had never anticipated. And that was a kind of painting in which there was no central image, but where activity and vitality was spread out over the entire surface so that you would look at a small painting or a huge painting and get the same discharge of energy everywhere and in very intense doses. This was very radical, and other artists eventually came around to doing this, but Pollock was the sort of the one who really blew it out.
Was there a negative reaction at the time because this was so different?
Enormous negative reaction. He barely ever sold a painting in his life outside of a very small circles of supporters. He never really made very much money. By today's standards, he made nothing. So that he was notorious, but he was also, unrewarded. And he's one of the last members of the old avant-garde, the kind of Garrett artist who suffers and dies and, you know, becomes famous posthumously.
That isn't so much the story anymore?
No, I mean, actually, it was never entirely the story.
Okay.
Rubens and Velazquez were famous and rich in their own day. So the idea of the Garrett artist is really a 19th century phenomenon. But there was a time when it was more true than not for many of the important artists, and Pollock was one example.
Another artist, a name I'm familiar with, and I've got to say I'm not as familiar with his work, Gerhard Richter.
Okay, Gerhard Richter is, from my point of view, one of the most important painters of the post-1945 era. And the 1945 marker is important because Gerhard was born in Nazi Germany. Actually, he was born just as Nazi Germany was becoming Nazi Germany. He lived through the war. He then had his youth in East Germany under the communist Stalinist regime and came to West Germany and to Western culture in 1961, moments before the Berlin Wall went up. And he had a second life after that. And in his own life, and that's a case where the life story does matter, mm-hmm. In his own life, he's had to resolve all these conflicts. What's it like to have a Nazi for an uncle? Actually, what's it like to have a major war criminal for a father-in-law, which he did? What's it like to have grown up making Stalinist pictures and then abandon that and also the rewards that went with it and to begin again as an unknown artist making work that at the very beginning he didn't even like that much, but he knew he had to make? So he's a story of adaptation, survival, learning, and then he has made some just drop-dead paintings that have changed the way we think about the art form.
How so?
One of the things he's done is he's given himself the permission to mix and match, so to speak. So he will make all over abstract paintings which are not like Pollock's, but take on some of the same issues. And then in the same afternoon, he will work on a painting which will look like Vermeer. And he sort of has dissolved this battle between figuration and abstraction, between the seemingly, you know, sort of urgent emotional making of a picture and the patient fine crafting of a picture. He's dissolved those distinctions by showing that they're actually alternating currents in individuals and in the history of art.
So you're talking about how he was wrestling with the same issues probably all of Germany was, the post-Nazi era, the Berlin Wall era, eventually reunification. Do you think that he means something different to a German than to the rest of us looking in from the outside?
I think he does somewhat, and I'll tell you one other piece of the puzzle. In 1995, I went to Germany to see him for the first time, actually, and to negotiate the acquisition by MoMA of a group of paintings called the October Cycle. And it's October 18th, 1977, is the date of the paintings and the title of the paintings. And they're about a group called the Baader-Meinhof Group, which was a group of left-wing student political people who became actual terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
And I acquired these paintings because I thought they were amazing paintings. But they addressed a situation which was in some way specifically German. And the story of this group and what it did is very much bound up in this post-war history and war guilt and so on. At the same time, we had the Weather Underground. We had the Black Panthers. We had the Symbionese Liberation Army. We had a whole lot of similar groups in this country. And no one in this country has ever tackled them in a serious way in pictorial art. And so I thought this would be interesting to have this work because it's such great painting, and there are reasons for that. But also, it would be interesting to see how Americans work through their own traumatic experience by considering that of someone in another culture.
It's amazing to think about how art, you think of something as so intensely personal and in a place and a time, and yet so often leaping beyond those bounds and becoming something of universal interest and appreciation.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Robert Redford's just made a film on the Weather Underground or something very similar to it, right? Mm-hmm. So this is really part of our experience, and Richter has from his side. And mind you, Richter was an anti-communist who had fled East Germany, who had no kind of romantic feelings about revolution whatsoever. And what his interest was in how idealistic people could start out doing the right thing and end up doing the wrong thing. That was the subject of these paintings. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we in this country would do well to consider.
Another artist I wanted to talk about, Louise Bourgeois, you've written about.
Yeah, a great deal. I knew her for 30 years. I knew her before she got really famous. I knew her after she got really famous. And she lived until she was 90, almost 98. And she's an amazing artist because this is somebody who grew up when modern art was new. She went to school and studied with Leger, the French Cubist painter. She was friendly with the Surrealists because they have their gallery in the building where she had an apartment. She came to New York, and she knew Jackson Pollock. She knew Mark Rothko. She knew all these people. But she was a woman, and being a woman in that context was really tough. And she was determined to become an artist in her own way, and she did. But it took her years and years and years to, one, get the confidence to do what she needed to do, and two, it took her even more years till her 80s to get the attention that she deserved. So it's about the long slog that many women have had, and Joan Mitchell's another, and the list goes on, get for women the kind of regard and consideration that male artists have had for many years.
When she found that confidence, as you mentioned, what did she bring to the art world? What was her influence then?
Profound. I mean, and one of the reasons that she was so important was that she was doing things that younger artists were doing, but doing them in even more radical ways and often doing them before the younger artists started, so that when younger artists came up with these ideas, they looked to her as a role model. So in 1966, for example, the great curator and critic Lucie Lepard did an exhibition called Eccentric Abstraction, which was one of the first major appearances of Eva Hesse and Bruce Nauman. And Louise, who was 20 or 30 years older than them, was in that exhibition. in the 1990s and late 80s, when neo-expressionism and neo-symbolism came along, Louise was in those exhibitions because she was fresh. It was new work she was showing. So the idea that, you know, one has this kind of nice sort of parabolic rise and fall in a career is nuts. You know, artists who are really determined have very erratic attention. They have very erratic work. But the long-lived artists of that kind do amazing things all their lives.
I had more artists I was going to ask about, but we're a little short on time. And I wanted to ask you, is there an artist or two today who are not famous yet that you're keeping an eye on and would suggest we check out?
I'm always keeping an eye on artists, mm-hmm. and there are many of them. One who is pretty famous but not well-known in this country is Raymond Pettibone, who I think is an extraordinary artist. Another is Jack Lerner, who's from Brazil. I mean, there are many artists that I have put in my exhibitions and written about. And the reason I write about a lot of them is because I don't think it's ever been a matter of the one or two top people. Mm. It's always been a kind of delta of artists moving at different speeds and doing different things, but all interconnected.
That was Robert Storr, curator, art critic, and dean of the Yale School of Art. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard will be back in on Monday. You are with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday. Today we'll look at the Midwest camping tradition known as the Pudgy Pie. First, like many of us, our federal lawmakers are off of work today. They've been in recess since last Friday. In fact, Congress members have a full roughly 265 days during which they're not required to be in Washington. That amount of time off in general is sometimes contentious, but what gets more contentious is what lawmakers do with their time. For example, House Majority Leader Eric Cantor's recent unexpected loss in his Republican primary is largely attributed to a loss of touch with his home district. On one hand, constituents want the lawmakers at home in touch with local issues. On the other, they want representatives in Washington getting stuff done. The balance can be tricky. Gannett Washington Bureau reporter Donovan Slack recently reported on where Wisconsin's representatives fall when it comes to the time they spend in Wisconsin versus how much time they spend in Washington. Donovan joins us now. Welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So when weighing this debate, more time in the district versus more time in Washington, they really can't win in a way. Let's hear the argument on both sides. What's the argument to spend more time here in Wisconsin or wherever that district might be?
Well, you know, spending more time at home, people argue, gives them more interaction with constituents. They get to hear more what their constituents feel and think and what they want them to do. And the hit on not spending enough time there is that they lose touch with what their constituents want, and therefore they aren't adequately able to represent those views in Washington.
But on the other hand, if they're spending all their time in their district, are they doing what they need to do to get the job done in Washington? That's the counterargument, I guess.
Exactly. There's a lot of people here in Washington who say they need to spend more time here so that they can build relationships and maybe overcome the gridlock. And there's also something to be said for learning more about the institution, how it works, how the committees work. If you're at home in Wisconsin, you're not going to spend a lot of time doing that.
Is there a growing trend toward valuing that district time more and having more contempt, at least in some parts of the public, for too much time in Washington?
Oh, absolutely. And, I mean, just look at the polls. Congress is at an approval rating of an all-time low. I think it was 7% last I saw. And if you spend too much time here in Washington, you become a member of this institution that people hate and less a resident of Wisconsin.
Well, you focused some on Wisconsin's delegation in a recent piece. Let's look at some of them. Representative Tom Petri, you talked about him illustrating the routines of a lawmaker who spends maybe more time in Washington. How does he split that up?
Well, yeah, he actually only spends about 36% of his time off in Wisconsin. And this could have been a major vulnerability for him if he decided to seek reelection. You know, he spends most of his time here in Washington, 70% or so, and that has already led critics to say, you know, he's gone Washington.
You know, before we get back to Wisconsin's delegation more, is there something about how close you live to Washington? If you're in Maryland, Virginia, it's easy to commute. If you're the further west you get, the harder it is to come back and forth to the district and to D.C.?
Well, absolutely, that argument could be made. I mean, look at these poor congresspeople from Hawaii. That's an hour flight. But when you talk about Wisconsin, it's a one-hour, you know, hour-and-a-half flight. So there really isn't that argument.
How did the rest of our delegation look when it came to splitting time, their time not in session? Are they at home in D.C.? What's the ratio?
Well, it's really interesting, but most of the newer elected members, those that were elected in the past 5 years, spent at least 180 days in Wisconsin, and that's out of 265 days they have off. So that's a good chunk of time. And you're looking at Representative Sean Duffy of Wausau. He spent 86% of his time off in Wisconsin. Mark Pocan, 71%. He's from Madison there. Reed Ribble from Green Bay, 70%. And then, of course, people like Petri or Representative James Sensenbrenner from Menominee, who have been in Congress for 35 years, spend most of their time here in Washington.
And how about our senators, apart from the congressional delegation? How do our two senators fit in?
Well, they're right about in the sweet spot in the middle. Tammy Baldwin spends 73% of her time off in Wisconsin, and Ron Johnson spends 70%. And that's pretty average.
Now, this is an issue. It sounds maybe just like some time management here, but this is an issue that can lose people elections, in part maybe people named Eric Cantor. Did this issue factor into his loss in a Republican primary?
Well, absolutely. That was the big reason everybody gave for Eric Cantor's loss of his primary bid, was that he didn't spend enough time in his Virginia district. And this is why this is an important question. I mean, there's really twofold reasons why this happens. If an opponent can argue that you have so-called gone Washington by spending too much time here, that's a real vulnerability at the ballot box. And I think that it's become a much more so of a vulnerability in an age of Tea Party activism. This is one of their prime tactics that they use. They used it against Cantor, and I expect them to use it more in the future, including in Wisconsin.
The fear is that, you know, my lawmaker is going to lose touch with their roots, with what we the people want in their district if they spend too much time in Washington. Is there any, I don't know how you'd measure this, is there any data that shows whether or not lawmakers behave differently if they're in Washington more?
There's not real data on that. I mean, it's hard to draw a line between how they act or how they perform in Congress versus, you know, and then correlate that somehow with the time they spend at home or here. What I can tell you is there's no public data at all showing their trips home except for Senate and House spending records, and those can be very tedious to go through. And that is what I did with this. I felt like it was worth it to get the real data.
Interesting. Yeah, that doesn't sound like a real exciting task.
No, but I think it's worth it. I mean, there's a lot of accusations that fly around, particularly in this day and age, of people don't spend enough time at home. So I thought, well, let's take a real close look and spend some time and figure out how much they actually do spend in Wisconsin.
Do you get a sense of maybe frustration from people in Congress that there's some value in both sides, obviously, in spending time in Washington, learning the system, getting things done, and there's value in being in the district? Is there frustration that they're being watched for how they handle that balancing act?
Oh, absolutely. And, I mean, I think it's a tough balance. The sweet spot is right in the middle, I am told, and it's hard to find that sweet spot and maintain it.
You know, Eric Cantor did lose, but he's kind of an exception. We see pretty high incumbency rates for people in Congress over the last 10, 20 years, I think. So is this something that maybe people are a little, the people in the public are annoyed with their congressperson, but when it all is said and done, it's pretty rare that they're going to punish him or her for that?
Well, you know, it seems to be an increasing phenomenon. I don't know, like you said, how much it's going to matter at the end of the day. But there is a sort of throw-them-all-out mentality that has dominated certainly discussion since 2010 when a major Tea Party wave took over the House.
So federal lawmakers have been on recess for about a week now. When they come back, I gather they're going to have just 28 days or so of congressional business before November elections to get something done, or if anything done. Is there an argument to be made with that little time to say, hey, maybe take this recess time, spend it in Washington, try to get things on the table for this rush period before elections?
You know, you would think so, but this is Congress we're talking about. They don't operate like the rest of us, I have to say. And I have yet to see a lawmaker here in town in D.C. I think they're all at home in their district.
Mm-hmm. And there's, you hear kind of maybe almost golden age talk from people in Congress, in the House and the Senate, saying, in the old days, yeah, we argued with each other, but we lived in the same place. Our kids went to the same daycares or schools. We had these personal connections with people in the other party, and it made it easier to compromise. Now that we have to spend more time in our district, that's less likely to happen. Is that just sort of a golden age fantasy, or is there really something to that?
I mean, I think there's something to it, but I also think it's a golden age fantasy. The reality is what it is. You know, you can spend all the time in the world saying, oh, gosh, I wish it was like that again. And it's just not.
All right, Donovan, thank you for crunching the numbers and sharing them with us today.
Thanks so much.
We've been speaking with Donovan Slack, Gannett Washington Bureau reporter, about how much time Wisconsin's Congress members spend in Wisconsin versus Washington. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Recently on the show, we talked to our assistant news director and food enthusiast Noah Ovshinsky about campfire cooking. Turns out Noah's not the only one on staff who fancies themselves a campfire cook. One of Central Time's own producers, Chris Molina, does a lot of cooking around the campfire as well, but he specializes in one thing, and one thing only, pudgy pies. He was mortified to learn that some people on staff didn't know what pudgy pies were, so he's here to explain what they are, why he thinks they're the perfect camping food. Chris, welcome to this side of the glass.
Hi, Rob. Happy 4th of July to you.
Well, I don't want to mortify you further. When you talked about pudgy pies, I smiled and nodded knowledgeably. I've never had a pudgy pie. I'd never heard of it. What is a pudgy pie?
Well, so when I first, you know, brought this up in a meeting, the reaction I got when I tried to explain it was, well, it's just a grilled cheese. Well, it's more than just a grilled cheese is what I'm here to tell you. It's basically, I mean, it is a toasted sandwich that you basically cook over a campfire. Mm. And to do that, you need a special pudgy pie iron, or I've also heard them referred to as hobo pies. But growing up, they were always pudgy pies. So I don't know if that's a regional thing or what.
At the store, would I actually look for something called a pudgy pie iron?
Yeah, absolutely. And it used to be you'd only be able to find them at a camping store, or like an REI or a Fontana or something, but now I've seen them in Target. I know if you go to Fleet Farm, they have them, and they seem to have come down in price a little bit, too. So it's a real cheap and easy way to eat while you're camping.
What does it look like, this iron?
So basically, it's a long, I would say maybe about a foot long. You've got like two little poles and a little kind of like metal iron on it. And it kind of like opens up. It's meant to kind of clasp together. The idea being you open it up and you put your two slices of bread in. So really, you know, one of the beauties of, you know, a pudgy pie is you don't need very many ingredients. And a lot of the times you don't really need to refrigerate anything. You know, so if you've got a cooler, you know, you can just throw some stuff in there. If not, you know, maybe not a big deal. But basically all you really need is your bread, and I usually recommend that people just pick up a loaf of white bread or something, because the iron usually is square. You can also get round ones, too, which I'll talk about in a minute. But with these square pudgy pie makers, it's really easy to fit one of those, you know, nice square pieces of sandwich bread in there versus, you know, some fancier bread, which tends to be maybe a little bit more rectangular.
You know, an artisan bread might be oblong, misshapen, not fit in the iron.
Right.
So we're basically talking about two pieces of bread with stuff in the middle, heated on, it looks sort of like I looked at pictures online, a George Foreman grill on a stick, and no plug, obviously.
Yeah, you could definitely say that. So I, you know, tend to go with the square one. I didn't realize the round one was, you know, something that existed until actually pretty recently. That's one where you can't really easily put, you know, a square piece of bread in there. The trick that I've seen people using is they'll actually take, you know, like Pillsbury crescent dough and put that in there, which I've never tried, which sounds sort of fantastic, actually. But yeah, all you need is the bread. Bring some butter or some cooking spray so that you don't burn the pieces of bread onto the iron, and then whatever fillings you want. And that's the great part about pudgy pie, is what I think makes it the perfect camping food, is you can really put anything you want on a pudgy pie, and it works for every meal of the day. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, dessert, you name it, you can make a pudgy pie for it.
We'll get into some of your fillings in a minute. Let's talk process a little more here. Is it like I've got a marshmallow on a stick and I'm waving my pudgy pie iron over the fire, or do I set it down near the fire? What do I do there?
Yeah, it kind of depends on how cooked you like your pudgy pie. I prefer to take my iron, and one thing I should say, if you're looking for an iron, I've seen longer ones and shorter ones. When you go look at the store for one, get a longer one so you're not burning your hand when you're sticking it into the fire.
Yeah.
But I would say, you know, put it into the fire and, you know, lay it maybe like close to a flame or on a log or something that's by coals. I mean, that way you don't burn your bread right away and everything cooks a little bit more even. I mean, you could stick it right in the fire if you do like, you know, the charred bread, but I mean, I like the slow cook, you know, and just, you know, flip it over every couple of minutes or so and just check it. You know, it's real easy to unclasp the thing and look. And yeah, it all kind of just depends on your personal taste.
Well, you've had this hot metal thing there. Is there like a button at this end or a pull that I open it up with? I don't have to touch the hot.
You don't have to touch the hot iron. So on the handle, it's a wooden handle, and there's a little clasp that kind of fastens it.
All
so you kind of undo the clasp and then just open it up with the handles, and then you can see what's going on inside. So yeah, you don't have to, you know, touch the scalding hot metal on the end of your pudgy pie iron.
This keeps getting better.
I'm telling you, man.
Don't have to scald myself. All right, I think I'm finally forming the picture of how this works. Let's get into some fillings. You said breakfast, lunch, and dinner. What would I put in my breakfast version of the pudgy pie?
Well, you know, a great thing that you can do is you can sort of make an omelet sandwich, if you will. So I think, you know, you can go out, you know, this might be something that you might not be able to find at the grocery store, but at a camping store, you can kind of find like pre-cooked scrambled eggs, which I've actually had. You know, my first thought was, ooh, pre-cooked scrambled eggs. I don't know about that. They're actually pretty good. Throw some of that in there, put, you know, maybe some bacon in there, whatever toppings that you would throw into an omelet. So maybe, you know, chop up some mushrooms or something, some green peppers, you know, maybe you want, you know, bacon bits or little chunks of ham or something, and just throw it in there and toast it. And all of a sudden, you've got a pretty easy breakfast. And, you know, this is something if you're camping with a family, too. I mean, it's going to make everyone in your family happy. If you've got kids, they're going to love this.
Oh, and you can mix and match what different people want and the different pies. Oh, some summer sausage, I think, would be great on that omelet sandwich.
Yeah, that sounds good, too. You know, bring some spices, bring some salt and pepper if you want. You know, do whatever you want to spice it up. It's going to taste good.
Okay, so for the rest of the meals of the day, what's your favorite? What's your favorite pudgy pie, Chris?
I am a pizza pudgy pie kind of guy, and this is another really easy thing that you can do. Just bring some cheese with you, some shredded mozzarella cheese. Bring some pizza sauce. So, you know, you'll butter the one slice of the... Well, both slices, you'll butter the bread and you'll put it into the iron so it doesn't, you know, stick in there. And then on the other side, you'll put the pizza sauce, you know, throw some cheese on it, maybe some pepperoni if you want, maybe some sausage. And again, you know, whatever you want on your pizza, like, you know, whatever you want to put in your omelet, just put it on there and go to town. And it is just a great tasting sandwich.
Yeah, and all of that, you don't need to refrigerate in advance.
Yeah, I think so. You know,
or in a cooler,
yeah,
you'd be okay.
You know, the cheese, you can probably go a day or two without being refrigerated. And the thing is, you know, it's camping. It's, you know, these sandwiches aren't going to be anything fancy, but, you know, that's why you go camping, though. You kind of want to get away from it all.
Is this a long-time memory of yours, or are you a recent pudgy pie convert?
Yeah, I remember doing this when I was a kid.
Okay.
I was also, I was in Boy Scouts, and I think that's when I first learned about this. So, you know, growing up, it was just kind of like something we did when we went camping, which, again, you know, kind of like goes to my mortification when I heard that people on staff didn't know this was. And I don't know if this is just a Midwest thing or if this is all over the place. I mean, you're a Midwestern guy too, Rob. You're from Michigan.
But I'm not a camping guy. I never have been. Sorry.
Okay.
I like camping with roof and shower.
Well, if you've got a fire pit in
the
backyard, you know, we can try it out.
Could do it over the grill.
I think I just invited myself over.
No.
Okay.
Well, I don't have a fire pit. But I could do it over the grill, though.
You could do it over the grill, I would imagine. I've never tried that, but yeah, as long as you've got the hot coals, I mean, it doesn't necessarily need to be in the fire. Yeah, I would imagine that would work out just fine.
Okay, tempt us with some other delightful pudgy pie fillings.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. I've been doing a lot of searching around online in preparation of this segment, and there are more pudgy pie Pudgy Pie blogs than I ever thought like would have existed on the internet. And I mean, it can be as simple as I saw someone, they took a can of like Chef Boyardee spaghetti, you know, that canned spaghetti, and they put that within the bread and they made a little spaghetti sandwich. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that at home you might be like, but on camping it's like, oh man, that sounds awesome. I really want to try that.
You had a taco one, I think, on your list.
Yeah, this is one that might take a little bit of legwork beforehand. This is something that you might need to cook the meat ahead of time. And this is, you know, another thing that you can do too. So, you know, while you're, you know, before you go on your camping trip, when you still have access to, you know, a home kitchen or a commercial kitchen or whatever, you know, cook some meat up ahead of time and just throw it in a Tupperware container and bring it with you. So, you know, just cook up some taco meats, so, and then bring with you, you know, a little bit of cheese. Maybe you have that left over if you're making pizza ones. You know, bring some sour cream if you want. Bring some extra taco sauce, a little bit of veggies, and just, yeah, make a taco pudgy pie.
One thing we haven't gotten to yet, Chris, the dessert.
Yeah, you know, you can kind of make pudgy pie s'mores, if you will. One thing I've seen is that, you know, instead of using like pizza sauce or whatever, just put peanut butter on there and then throw, you know, maybe half of a chocolate bar in there. If you want to put a marshmallow in there too, that sounds great.
Yeah.
I've never tried that myself, but, you know, that sounds great. And a lot of times too, you know, this could be a great way to complement, you know, when you make s'mores, you always end up with like one too many of something. You're never going to use all of the stuff. So you have like leftover graham crackers or leftover marshmallows, but not chocolate or whatever. So just throw whatever you have left over, you know, into the iron and make it dessert pudgy pie.
Okay, and for a non-chocolate dessert maybe in our last 30 seconds or so?
Yeah, if you're craving something fruity, what you can do is just take some pie filling, actually. You know, get some cherry pie filling or some apple pie filling, and that's all you need. You know, maybe you want to bring a little bit of whipped cream with you to top it off. But yeah, just, you know, scoop a little in there, and boom, you've got yourself a quick and easy desserts.
A lot of great ideas for 4th of July weekend. Campers out there, hope you still have time to stop at the store. Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Rob.
All right, now get back to work. I mean, hey, do you want to post a thing on Facebook? Maybe people can share their pudgy pie favorites.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll get something up there and I hope to hear from you with your recipes.
That's on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us about your favorite pudgy pie.